Welcome to the State Support Team 11 podcast. I'm your host, Eric Neal, and today we are joined by Dr. Antoinette Miranda. Antoinette is the interim chair of teaching and learning at The Ohio State University and also represents District 6 on the State Board of Education. Dr. Miranda, welcome. How are you?
I'm fine, and it's really nice to be back to talk with you, Eric.
Yes, you as well. We really enjoyed our first conversation back there. It was, I want to say, early 21, late 20. Yes. I can't remember. Things have been a blur. But that was really well received and a really critical timing to talk about cultural competency. You know, last time we did discuss cultural competency, and we thought it would be great to have you back and talk about culturally responsive practices, but more specifically about how to have these difficult conversations around race and culture. Mm-hmm. So there's been many high profile issues, unfortunately, around social justice that have been in the news since the last time that we talked, and even some right here in Columbus. Mm-hmm. You know, talking about them with students, it can often be a challenge for educators. Do you feel like it's important to have these conversations with students?
You know, Eric, I think it's always been really important, but even more so now. People have kind of wondered why all of a sudden we have really sort of embraced social justice. And I think in part because we are home more. We get to see what's happening out there. And people have really started to realize the inequities that exist. And I think if we don't think students realize this, they do. They see TV, they have their friends. Many of them are aware of it, and many of them are very curious about having conversations about it. One of the things we recognize is that some kids are having these conversations in their home. So they're able to participate because they have these deep conversations, but we also know that some kids don't. I think the most critical thing is that teachers have to have a comfort level, and students will sort of sense if the teacher doesn't have that comfort level. And so one of the things I would suggest is that educators within their group, within their school, are developing little pods of talking, are able to share, like, how do we approach this? What are the kind of things you say? How can I be comfortable with this? I think it's a mistake to brush it under the rug. There is an awareness. One of the things we have in our country is that we are afraid to talk about race. It's almost like race is a taboo subject. Yet, race permeates, whether we want to believe it or not, permeates almost everything we do. And so I do think teachers need to have those conversations. And part of that, I do think, is culturally responsive practice that we're engaging in. And it can be connected to a subject you're talking about, but it also can be where students just ask a question. You say, let's have a dialogue. You don't have to participate in the discussion, but I think some students are very curious about what is happening. And it doesn't mean the teacher has to give her experience, but she can facilitate where there is a dialogue that's occurring. One of the things that we don't do very well in this country is have dialogue. We want to shut it down because we're so afraid of what I don't know, because the reality is there is systemic racism in the United States. We do have a racial issue in the United States. And the only way we're going to overcome it is to be able to talk about it. So when I think about doing these things, I think that it's really important for teachers initially to take inventory of their own biases, to kind of think about, where do I stand on this? Can I lead a conversation that allows students to be able to dialogue and have their own perspective? One of the ways we can start to do this is to integrate race and culture into the curriculum. And I'm not advocating one way, but we can talk about these things. These are realities. In terms of looking at the United States, we are not a homogeneous nation. We are a heterogeneous nation with many, many cultures. And to ignore that, I think, does a disservice to what we are as Americans. So children should be provided a window with diverse experiences, being able to hear their classmates, being able to, and there's a lot of things out there that you can utilize. One of the new places, it used to be called Teaching Tolerance, and now I love the name much better. It's called Learning for Justice. I used to kind of be bothered by the tolerance, like, Eric, I'm going to tolerate you.
Right.
I'm glad that they now changed it. So I think this website, Learning for Justice, has a lot of strategies and ideas that teachers can go to that they can be comfortable. But I think it's great for teachers to have that dialogue with each other so they can look at where do I stand and what do I know, but other teachers may be able to give strategies for these things.
No, that makes a lot of sense to me. You know, I started off as a history teacher, so I'm a social studies background. And
yeah,
I had a lot more background knowledge than my colleagues on a lot of things just by the nature of my degree. But I also had the opportunity of things just coming up more frequently in class naturally, and having, you know, those entry points into these conversations that, you know, allow you to kind of, you know, flow in and out of current events connected to and in the context of these things that happened historically. But, you know, there's been that. I mean, you can call it a whitewashing, you can call it, you know, kind of a watering down of, especially when you talk about United States history, you know, we're really quick to talk about, you know, fascism or communism or those things and go into great detail. But, you know, the regular textbook, you know, U.S. history is very, you know, from that patriotic lens, and, you know, we came here and the natives helped us, and it was, you know, it was all kumbaya and all this. And I think, you know, I don't know that it's ever too early from my standpoint, from being a historian, to start just saying, you know, from a fact basis, you know, here are for, you know, documents, here are, you know, those, you know, resources that you can look at and see that in their own words or, you know, witness accounts, the things that happened. And I think part of what maybe leads to these decisions or these conversations being so complicated now is you don't get the real history. So if you're a student that the only story you ever hear about America is, you know, this is what happened. And it's really this kind of rose colored, you know, vision of what things were. It's kind of shocking to you all of a sudden to hear that there is systemic racism or that these things take place. But if you follow just the actual history, it's laid out pretty clearly for you that it was founded this way. People were exploited, the native people and slaves brought from Africa, indentured servants from poor European countries. There was all sorts of this in our DNA from the very beginning. And so I think the more we can, from a historical standpoint, just be honest about that it maybe would lead to easier conversations down the road.
You know, Eric, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think most of the people that talk about not wanting another history, there is no other history. It's American history.
That's the history.
That people don't really know the full depth of the historical facts. And how not only African Americans, but Native Americans, Asian Americans, Latino Americans were really oppressed in very harsh ways in the United States. And so we don't get that in our history books. Most kids don't know about Jim Crow laws. They don't remember that there were drinking fountains. That is a part of our history. That was up until 1960. So for people to say, oh, that's where our founding fathers had flaws.
Right.
They had wonderful ideas about what this country would build on. But the reality is we were very brutal to many segments of the population. And to not talk about that makes no sense to me. Why in the world would we not talk about that? So, you know, here's another thing that I'm going to talk about. You know, with my students, we were doing some things on Appalachian culture, right? And I found an article back in the 1920s when we had the eugenics movement. And I would bet most people that have an Appalachian background don't understand this, but elite whites put forth with the eugenics movement, because initially they were looking at why rural folks weren't doing as well in education. And they started focusing on Appalachians. And so they didn't really want to deal with the poverty thing. So the eugenics movement actually put forth that Appalachians weren't achieving and could not get out of poverty, weren't successful in school because they were intellectually inferior. I bet a lot of Appalachians would be shocked to know that elite whites describe them that way. And so when you look at many of the stereotypes that we have, that's where it comes from. And so if anybody is interested in that article, I'll make sure I drop it to you. But those are the realities that people don't understand, where some of our stereotypes came from, and how these ideas were put forth. So when we think of the eugenics movement, oftentimes we think about African Americans. But what we also know was that Appalachians were lumped into that in terms of how they were viewed and the explanation for why they were not doing, why they were not more successful in schools. And so, you know, we have to look at what's the purpose. And yet in our code, in the Ohio code, it actually says we are supposed to give a balanced history, and it has all the groups laid out there. So when people say, oh no, we can't do this, it actually is in our code that when we're teaching, we should be giving a balanced history of African-Americans, Native Americans, Asian Americans, all of these groups. It doesn't say we're supposed to give one side. It says we're supposed to give a balanced history of all of those groups. And that's really what we're asking teachers to do. Teachers should be allowed to teach what they know. The other thing is something you hit on, and I can't remember where I saw it, is that teachers are not supposed to teach social studies, and I think you'll agree with this, to make patriots.
Right.
Supposed to be teaching, here's the information. We're asking you to become intellectually inquisitive of understanding about our history. That's not the purpose of schooling in America. The purpose is not to make patriots. The purpose is not to have people love or hate our country. It's about teaching them, here's what our country is about. Here's what math is about, reading is about, to make your informed decisions. And I think we've missed the boat on the purpose of teaching history, for example.
Yeah, I think, again, this is almost in a way not an accident, the same way that, you know, these systemic race issues are not an accident. You know, when right. you think about when public education started in America, followed the factory kind of worker, yes. right? So it was like,
and there was an indoctrination back then,
right? So you weren't
many immigrants. They wanted them to think one way, but that has changed since. So yeah, go
yeah.
ahead.
You're yeah. Right. So they didn't necessarily want you to be a deep thinker. They wanted you to sit in rows and follow directions and respond to the bell when it told you to go to lunch and come back when it rang again and do all of those things. I think. Again, from a history standpoint, we are actually trained in our college programs, our licensed programs, to teach people critical thinking and how to yeah. compare and contrast things and how to do all of these things. You know, it's not been that long since the Common Core state standards, which the Ohio mm-hmm. state standards still follow those very, mm-hmm. very closely. But when that shift was made from you're going to read this, and then one day in the spring, I want you to remember it. And bubble the circle for the thing that you remembered onto, I want you to read this written from this perspective and now read this other thing from the opposite perspective, compare and contrast them, and then mm-hmm. come to your own conclusion about what you think using the evidence from the writing, which right. is what we need to be doing, but is not really what's taught outside mm-hmm. of, I'd say, social studies and what's been the status quo for so long. So I think, you know, beyond just being, having that cultural competency, we need yeah. to help to develop these other subject areas yeah. to teach children how to do that, to have critical conversations, mm-hmm. to do all of that stuff. You know, there's a movement called Philosophy for Children that they did a lot of research on that they said actually increases math and reading scores. And even in students of poverty or different ethnic groups or anything, without doing any sort of math or reading stuff, because yeah. it's really teaching you how to think critically, which you can apply to anything in your life. And so I like that you've kind of come out with these strategies and these ideas for, like, how can we actually support these educators? What are some other things mm-hmm. we can do to, you know, beyond at the university level, integrating these things into the license programs, but what can we do yeah. for the people who are out there in the field right now?
Yeah. Because here's the thing, when you're talking about talking, We know that white people are less exposed to what to do around race and more likely to be socialized to avoid racial matters and see them as dangerous. Kids have a need to process what is going on. And so that's one of the things I've sort of kind of that sort of puzzles me is like, what is your fear? What is your fear about talking to these about these issues? And, you know, I've heard the words indoctrination thrown around and victimization thrown around and all of these words. And I think they're catchphrases to put us off. Like we're diverting ourselves from the real issue. And the real issue is about understanding how race has impacted us in the United States and how in 2021, it still has an impact. I teach a diversity course. And so I have many of my students and I tell you, my especially my white students that come, even, not just from small towns, but they all say like, why didn't I learn this in history? Why didn't I learn this in social studies? And I basically, you know, put things out and we have discussions about them. And I have what I want them to do is become critical thinkers to sort of explore these first person stories, to explore these historical things. And it's ironic that when we went to Zoom and so that, you know, I always would give readings, right? And you know, but you always wonder how they really read these things. So we went to Zoom, we had discussion board, which forced them to read these things. And it was fascinating because I had them read things like about Wounded Knee and I had them read things about the Jim Crow law. And I had them read things about Plessy versus Ferguson. And I had them read things about laws about for LGBTQ. So they had to read like these court cases. And all of a sudden the light bulb went off and they were like, wow, these things happened so long ago. But here I can see today how we're still living with some of these things. I can see today the systemic racism. So, you know, you as a social studies teacher, I think you can understand that when you look at things that were real in the United States, because we have tons of documentation of this, the students in my class become critical race thinkers, critical thinkers of race. That's why I want to call them critical thinkers of race, as well as social class, as well as gender, as well as all these other isms that are out there. And then they're able to make their decisions and move forward and think about how do I become a person who engages in socially just practice? Because now they have this background to know that it's not always equitable for all kids in K-12. So I really act as a facilitator. I provide them with information and we try to look at the other side and say, why is this happening? What do you think is the issue? But we first start talking about that race is taboo, and I get them to think about, we got to talk about race in here and not be afraid of it. And so really what I'm trying to get them to do is to be culturally competent, but also how to engage in culturally responsive practices, and also how to engage in those difficult conversations. But here's what they tell me. They say, you gave me the language to be able to do this. And that's why I think it's so important that teachers talk with each other about it so they have the language to be able to address this. And so many of them would go home and talk to their families and they talk about, let me tell you what I learned. And sometimes the families were a little skeptical, but they also said I had the language to approach these conversations, which I didn't have before. And I think that's the other important piece for teachers to be able to start to talk about this. They have to have the language to be able to engage in it. And so as a result, you have to have resources. You have to have your own conversations before you engage in it.
Yeah, you know, individually we do. We need to build up every person because, you know, people talk about, you know, the system and that the people are the system.
Yes.
Right. There are these structures and frameworks and things, but they're made up of people that are interacting in all these roles and doing all of these things. And, you know, it's one thing to build up the skills, but it's almost another thing that if you're serious as an organization,
yes,
about their diversity, equity, and inclusion, that you, in a way, not only just give permission, like openly to everyone and let everyone know that this is what we are really about, and that these conversations are going to take place, and that, you know, we're going to communicate with people. But if you ever want to know more, we're happy to have you in. Mm-hmm. But it's really almost giving permission to your teachers to have those conversations, and right. that if it does go, you know, outside of where you were trying to go and problems yeah. arise, that we'll work on it together in a yeah. transparent way, and that, you know, we'll have your back. Because without that, people that feel comfortable will probably do it. People that don't will probably yeah. still shy away. And,
yeah,
you know, I think you and I have talked before about that. You know, I have a good friend that does equity work, and he's always saying, you know, there's real work. And then there's performative. And there's people who want to use the words and want to say, you know, hey, our organization cares about this, but they're not willing to talk about systemic racism and all right. that, you know. And I think that's a good transition for us about, you know, how do we help our adults? It's one thing mm-hmm. for us to support teachers in having these conversations. How do we help have these conversations internally and create these type of organizations that we want to be, that we strive to be?
You know, we need to learn to listen to each other and not discount others' experience. But we also need to recognize that people are still afraid to talk about race. And so, sorry, the Learning for Justice website, I think, has a lot of resources for doing that. I think we also have to be careful that we're not distracted by really what's going on now, where we're passing legislation, where we're telling teachers you can't do this. And I find it really fascinating that these are often led by white folks that have not experienced racism, that have not experienced discrimination, have no idea what it's like to walk in the shoes of Black and brown and Native Americans and Asians' shoes. And yet there seems to be this fear, because if you think about it, we have now made in this work almost white kids victims. Like, oh my God, we are going to make white kids have to listen to this and feel bad. Here's my guess. White kids won't feel bad. The other misconception is that nobody's out there teaching critical race theory. Teachers are not going into the classroom saying, we are going to teach CRT. It's a conceptual framework. It's an epistemology. It's something that's really in the ivory tower. And I want to read this quote because it's out of the Atlantic and I think it's great. And it says, as with other academic frameworks before it, the nuances of critical race theory and the debate around it were obscure when it escaped the ivory tower. And I think that's important. This was an ivory tower. This was a university college concept that is now invaded. And so it's incorrect information that's being put out there. And so again, I would say, what are we fearful of? And so we need to have a conversation about this. And in fact, I, as a state school board member, somebody came forward talking about critical race theory, and it's probably the 15th presentation. And somebody had just started studying. And I said to him, I've heard people say that Black children will be victimized by doing critical race theory. I've heard people say about the indoctrination. I said, so what I want to know is, where is the research that shows that teaching critical race theory does those things? Yeah. And he couldn't produce it. And I said, so I want you to quit saying these things because you have no data or research to back up. And I think that's the important thing to know here. People are spouting things that there is no research or data to back it up. And so we have to talk about it. The other thing you said, I think what I often hear is people make up systems. There's no systemic racism. People do this. Well, people do it because they're a part of a system.
Right.
Owns it. Yeah. And so that's what we have to understand, is that the way the system is designed, and maybe it's by accident, maybe that was not their initial intention, but we have to look at that system, and then we have to look at people that perpetuate that system. And so those are hard conversations, which we don't want to have, but that are really necessary to have. So I think, you know, if when we're looking at organization, when we're looking at schools, I still look at the whole child and how do we prepare our young people for a country that is amazing, that is still trying to live up to its ideals. But we also have to recognize it has its flaws.
Right.
It's okay to say it has its flaws, but recognize that those flaws also impact people on a very personal level today. And how do we make sure we're not complicit in that? And how do we make sure that we understand these things? And how do we make sure that we're going forward, engaging in culturally responsive practices and looking at socially just practices? I want to just do, I want to give a definition. There's a lot of definitions about culturally responsive practices, but this is a broad one. They're essentially involved recognizing and incorporating the assets and strength all students, notice all students, bring into the classroom and ensuring that learning experiences from curriculum through assessment are relevant to all students. So culturally responsive teaching is about using students' cultural experiences in daily instruction, embracing native language and students' families as assets, because we often come from a deficit model. How do we stop doing that? Creating a classroom environment that represents and respects all students and communicating clear, high expectations to everyone. You know, that, you know, and it can be much broader than that. So when I think about school psychology, how do we as school psychologists engage in culturally responsive practices? And that's about understanding assessments and understanding how they may be biased against students and, you know, not only minoritized students, but even poor students that don't have those skills. So we have to all think about what does it mean to be have culturally responsive practice or socially just practices. And I think for me, it's about recognizing all students in our classroom, understanding that they have assets and strengths, and thinking about how do we bring that out in the classroom to honor them so that they have a sense of belonging in that classroom. That to me is the important thing.
No, I'm with you 100%. And I really think that something that stood out to me, I just recently took a course for diversity, equity, and inclusion for a certificate from, it was through the University of South Florida. They offered this for free. And it was from a more of a corporate standpoint. You know, it was sponsored by an international engineering firm. They were really, you know, thinking of it from the business standpoint of this is good for your bottom line. You know, you'll have less attrition rates and
right.
You know, all this stuff, which I didn't necessarily like, but they did come up with some really strong, like, things that you can do if you are serious about being this type of organization. And, you know, like one thing that stood out to me was for like, you know, people with disabilities. So it was saying in your hiring practices, for one thing, be aware of things that don't even matter, like the ability to lift 40 pounds. I don't ever lift 40 pounds at my job ever.
Yeah.
So you're excluding people by putting something like that, and everyone does it. But even going a step further and saying, you know, in your posting, we encourage people with disabilities to apply. And, yeah. And I think it's little things that you can do in your organization to signal to people within and people without that you're serious and this is what you're really about. So, you know, in your vision and mission, making sure that these things are in there as a school district. You know, in your hiring practices, you know, we value a diverse workforce and encourage, you know, LGBTQ people of color, like whether people with disabilities to apply, things like that. But then, you know, even within to develop and intentionally teach people how to have these conversations with each other, because I think, you know, being a white person and, you know, trying to be an ally and trying to do certain things, there are times when it feels kind of perilous where you're thinking, you know, I would like to start having this conversation, but what happens if it gets to the point where someone says something that's not true? And and then what if it gets heated? And you know, a lot of times your gut reaction is, oh, wow. Maybe I just don't have this conversation and I'll talk to someone else later. But I think if we can establish, you know, these rules and policies and things that the outline, you know, one of the companies that presented during my training was really great, where they said, we would never discriminate against anyone's religion, against their personal beliefs, against any of these things. What you believe is what you believe. But while you're here, we respect all people and listen to all voices. Yeah. And so what it did was it didn't take people who maybe are having a hard time with diversity, equity, inclusion, and, mm-hmm. and exclude them.
Right.
But it said there are rules for how we engage with each other here at this workplace. And I think, yeah. you know, the more we can do that, the more we can be intentional in our organizations, it gets us away from that performative equity yeah. and down to really actually attempting to be equitable. It's never going to be yeah. perfect, but, no. you know, doing our best.
Yeah. As a person that's been doing diversity for just years, you know, to see what has happened in the last 6 months and to see people come out and to see people say, I want to know, how can I be an ally? How can I help? And I think it's the next generation. I think it's that next generation that will think differently about some of these things. I think it's this, in part of it, let's call it out. There's a fear of a certain group of people that are afraid of losing power.
Right.
I mean, we like don't want to talk about that. But me, having done diversity work for so many years, I think there's this element of power. And so what we do is we do fear mongering. We talk about divisiveness. We use these things because then that sort of wraps people in. So what happens? You get distracted from the real work that needs to be done out there. I also want to just say that I loved your example of the disability, because I have a son that's spastic quad, cerebral palsy. He's 27. But fortunately he has language. And so one of the things is about what you're talking about is what they call carving out a job for things they can do. And he works at Head Start 3 days a week, and they carved out this position for him. And I remember I went to the teachers because this one classroom they said, yes, we want to take him. And so how did Head Start sort of deal with it? They pay the teachers a little bit extra money. Why? Because he cannot feed himself. So again, that's something you didn't think about. He got his 2-year certificate. But one of the things I asked the teachers, I said, help me understand why you agreed to have him as part of the classroom. And she said, because our kids need to understand that there are people with disabilities in the world, and they can work and be friends. And it's absolutely adorable to see these 3, 4, and 5-year-olds when he's leaving to call him Mr. Jimmy to hug his wheelchair. Mm-hmm. but also give credit to the teachers about how they have engaged him to be a part of this classroom. He absolutely loves this job. And so, but I'm grateful to the director who said, we're going to carve out a position for him. And that's what you need with disabilities, is for kids. And so I know there are many parents, many teachers who are parents of children with disabilities that says, if a job could just carve out a position, then they can make it. So some people would say he's an assistant teacher. And I say, yeah, but, you know, he can talk. The kids understand him. It's sort of amazing that they do. And the teachers love having him around. And so right. Now he's been there 2.5 years. He feels like he has purpose. And so, again, that's another group we don't talk about as much, but that's one that's also very real in terms of how do we provide equitable opportunities for people with disabilities.
Right. And I think what you said was really important as well is it's not some sort of charity case or handout. It's a right. net benefit to them, the yes. organization, the kids. Everyone is participating and everyone is benefiting, which is what we really want to get to yeah. with the equity conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. I think knowing that, I will kind of also say another thing. One of the things I have my students do in the diversity class is to interview somebody from a different cultural group. And a lot of times they'll go back to somebody in high school that was their best friend, and they start interviewing them. And they often talk about how shocked they are Because here's the thing, they only learned the surface culture. They didn't learn the deep culture. They were never in their house. So they learned that they eat different kind of foods. They learned that sometimes they felt uncomfortable because their food that they ate was different than what other American kids ate. They learn about some of the challenges of being from a different culture. And the students say, I had no idea. They had no idea because we didn't engage in conversations. So there was a lot that their friend was like them, but there were also a lot of things. And oftentimes their friend said, thank you. Thank you for talking to me about my culture and letting me share that with you.
Yeah.
To remember, those differences are not deficits. They're amazing. That's what makes this country so wonderful. And we don't even realize all the things we've adopted from all these other cultures, you know? I mean, our number one condiment is not ketchup. It's salsa. Right. So, you know, we don't even realize that. So I just hope that people will open their minds to learning and not be afraid, because that's what this is. It's fear-mongering. And I hope that people will think about, what is the best interest of my kids and what can I learn from each other?
No, definitely. It's just tuning out the distractions and engaging and empowering with the people in your organization to understand this work and to mm-hmm. be able to navigate it. So I know that we talked about this last time we talked, but I know you have a summer institute coming up.
Yes.
Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
We are so excited about this. We have 60 different sessions. I'll give you a little bit more about it. In session enrollment will go live this week. I've sent you that link. We have around 60 unique offerings that cover all sorts of things. There's a wide range of contact hours offered. And the sessions are available from $30 to $450. So it's very economical. In terms of doing that, you can sign up for one 3-hour CEU, or you can even sign up for a whole class. Some of them are in themes, so you can do a whole theme around some other areas, or you can pick and choose. So we're very excited. Everything is virtual, so you don't have to, you can do it in your backyard, you can do it in your living room, you don't have to go anywhere. And so I am very excited about this because it's open to all teachers in the state of Ohio, as well as other ones. So I hope people will take advantage of this. There are just really some amazing people that are leading these sessions. I'm doing two. So I'm doing one on social-emotional learning, and I'm also doing one around Black Girl Magic, helping Black girls strive and thrive in the educational system so that they can be academically successful. So I hope people will check it out. I've already checked out the website and the sessions are there and live and ready for people to sign up. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to share that.
Oh, absolutely. What's that website address that you have?
That website is https://// summerinstitute1word.ehe.osu.edu/.
Perfect. No, I'm really looking forward to that as well. And, you know, every one of those topics are part of my work, near and dear to my heart. And, you know, I'm hoping to get in there and attend that as well myself. You know, anything else you'd like to talk about before you go?
The only thing I will add is that this was a new book in my diversity class. People had really recommended it as How to Be an Anti-Racist by Imran Kendi. I would suggest if people want that as some summer reading, that would be great. And then I think there's another book that I've recently heard about that I plan to get, and it's The Sum of Us. I was hoping for it was in paperback. I like paperback books, but I see that it's only in hardback. But it's through Amazon, and it's still pretty inexpensive for hardcover, $17.98. But it's called The Sum of Us, What Racism Cost Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. It is new. It's February 16th, 2021, so it's hot off the press. So I'm looking forward to reading that. It's by Heather McGee. And so I think that may be a good one. I love the title. So I think there'll be some good things in there.
Awesome. If people like to know more about you and the work that you do at The Ohio State University, how should they get a hold of you?
My email, miranda.2@osu.edu. But unfortunately, I don't know what my website address is, but if you put me in there, it can go to my website. That's not quite updated, but there is a lot of things there. But if people want to know more, feel free to email me and I would be happy to send you information that you want to address any of your other concerns. So yeah, miranda.tu@osu.edu.
That's great. Well, that wraps up our discussion for today. Once again, I'd like to thank our special guest, Dr. Antoinette Miranda. If you'd like to know more about Dr. Miranda's upcoming event and our other professional development opportunities, you can check out our website. It's at sst11.org or SST11 Facebook page or on Twitter at SST Region 11. If you'd like to reach me, you can send me an email. I'm at eric.neal@esco.org. Until next time, I'm Eric Neal. Thanks for listening.